Universität Hamburg.
Well, if you allow me, I'd like to start by telling a joke, but you don't have to worry, it isn't funny. Okay, besides, I realized it's a German joke, so perhaps it's old here, so you already know it. Okay, sorry. It's from the German Democratic Republic. It's about a German man who finds a job in Siberia. So, since he knows that the censors will read all his letters, he creates a code with his friends. Do you know it? He says, okay, if the letter is written in blue ink, it means that everything I said is true. But if it's written in red ink, it means everything is a lie. You don't have to believe it. So he goes to Russia, and a few weeks later, his friends receive a letter that says, dear friends, everything is wonderful here. The shops are full. Food is abundant. Apartments are large and properly heated. Cinemas show films from the West. And there are many beautiful girls ready for an affair. The only thing you can get is red ink. So, I told this joke because I read it in one of Slavoj Žižek's books, Welcome to the Desert of the Real. And Žižek says that what he finds interesting in this joke is that how the worker, and knowing that he cannot follow the code, he finds a way to make clear that he's lying by mentioning the impossibility of lying. Žižek says, this is the situation in which censorship works in liberal democracies. That we believe we are free because we lack the language to express our own freedom. That is, we don't have the red ink. And I think this joke will be useful to make my point clear, because this is the same situation which the characters in M.T. Anderson's novel live. In their society, in the novel, 70% of the population have an implanted chip in their brains, which is called the FID, hence the title of the novel. This FID keeps people permanently connected to a future version of the Internet. So any other technological device, such as computers, TV sets, VCRs, and so on, are completely unnecessary. Thanks to the feed, they live in a what they call an oniric culture, where they can communicate by means of images instead of talking. As they say, their letters are, and I quote, like flocks of dove released from under our hats. It is a society also where any kind of information is immediately available. So studying has become a thing from the past. Schools have been substituted by school trademark, which is run by corporations, and where students, instead of learning useful things such as history, math, and so on, they learn how the world can be used, which is basically how to use their feet. You see, the world is has become the field, the net. So they learn, and I quote again, how to work technology and how to find bargains and what's the best way to get a job or how to decorate our bedroom. That's what they learn in school. It's a society also that's based on massive and compulsive consumption. And this is the world in which Titus and Violet, the protagonists, who are two teenagers, meet and start a relationship. Titus is from a wealthy family and Violet is from a poor family, since her father is a professor at university. So she is not at ease with the situation which she's living, so she tries to fight the feed. But like in the worker in Zizek's no joke, she lacks the language to articulate her unfreedom. She tries to rebel, but the fit is so much in her that when her small one-person revolution fails, she realizes that she really wanted, her idea of a happy life, is in fact borrowed from the fit, especially from the sitcoms. One of the key moments in the novel is when Violet meets Titus at a mall and she tells him about her new project, which is resisting the fit. As Violet explains, corporations use the fit to control their movements, what they buy, what they like, or what they show some interest in order to gather information about their tastes. Their purpose is to do demographic studies that allow corporations to divide population into different types, so they can provide people with personalized advertisements and banners. This way, and I quote Violet, they keep making everything more basic, so it will appeal to everyone, and gradually everyone gets used to everything being basic. So we get less and less varied as people, more simple, end of quote. One might say, using Zizek's term, that the fit is the ultimate pervert marketing. See, it doesn't give you what you desire, it tells you how to desire. So to rebel against the fit, Violet has decided to create a customer profile that, in her words, it's so screwed that no one can market to it. With this purpose, she starts asking about the most varied things she can think of, and then she doesn't buy them. For instance, they go to a shop and she asks for searchlights, and the clerk starts showing them her some models. And then she tells the clerk that it's not for her car, but she wants to put them on her belly, and leaves the shop. And another shop, she goes with Titus, her boyfriend, and they start looking at dresses, and the clerk thinks she's looking for something for her, and she takes one and says, don't you think he looks cute in this dress? And then they leave and buy nothing. At first, it seems that Violet is succeeding because she's contacted by Nina, her personal and virtual customer assistant, who tells her that they have noticed that Violet has been showing interest in many products, but she has bought none. So she offers help to find products, and I quote, that are uniquely the woman known as Mrs. Violet Dern. End of quote. You see, she's suffering. Okay, we will find what's you. You know. Okay, but this warning is, well, this communication is the first warning of the tragedy that is awaiting Violet. As we will see. Well, Violet's strategy, that of creating difference as a means of resisting capitalist simplification of people into types, is very similar to that advocated by Tony Negri in his porcelain workshop. In this work, Negri considers that, and I quote, we have never been told what building democracy, freedom, equality, and wealth means in a world that capitalism thinks it can asphyxiate by annihilating all possibility of resistance. End of quote. In this state of affairs, difference, according to Negri, equals resistance. Both Violet and Negri coincide in considering that the homogenization process carried on by capitalism on society neutralizes the individual. This way, it is only, and I quote Negri, through creativity, lifestyles, and the destruction of all forms of essence, and end of quote, that difference, and therefore resistance, can be achieved. Violet believes that by creating an impossible profile, one that doesn't fit into any of the already existing types, she will become invisible for companies. That is, she will escape the fit's control. She intends to become an individual. But to achieve that, first, she must stop being a mere consumer, a part of the capitalist system. And she tries to do so by marking her uniqueness, her difference. In the words of Negri, difference corresponds to the preliminary moment of constitution of a subjectivity separating itself in order to exist, which is more or less what Violet is trying to do. Nonetheless, Varya Masumi, in an interview with Mary Surnasi, argues that capitalism, rather than condemning difference, profits from it. Following the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze, he argues that capitalism has gone through a major reconfiguration since the Second World War. This new reconfiguration has led from control as power over to focusing more and more on, and I quote, the transitions between institutions than on the institution themselves. End of quote. In other words, there has been a shift from what Foucault called disciplined societies to what Deleuze calls control societies. The consequence of this is that capitalism does no longer try to promote normalcy in a Foucaultian sense. But we should be aware that this loosening of normalcy must not be seen as a liberation. On the contrary, it's part of capitalism dynamic. And I quote Masumi again, it's capitalism's own form of power. It's no longer disciplinary institutional power that defines everything. It's capitalism's power to produce variety, because markets get saturated. Produce variety and you produce a niche market. The odds of affective tendencies are okay as long as they pay. End of quote. That is, in late capitalism, creating difference is not, as Negri claims, a way of resisting. It is just the opposite. Creating difference is creating new market niches, new spaces for capitalism to grow and avoid the collapse that market saturation would involve. Still, Masumi agrees with Anderson and Negri when they claim that corporations, as the agents of capitalism, seek to reduce population into types. I quote, individual consumers are being inducted into these collective processes, rather than being separated out and addressed as free agents who are supposed to make an informed consumer choice as rational individuals. In other words, people are being commodified, they are being reduced from their status of subjects to that of consumers. The new form of control is no longer based on repression, on discipline, but on the barcode or the PIN number. The world is divided into a series of gateways or checkpoints that the consumer must cross, leaving a trace that is gathered and studied by corporations. As we can see, this situation is not very different from that described by Anderson in his novel. In both cases, and I quote, real power starts after you have passed, because you have left a trace. Something has registered. Those registrations can be gathered to piece together a profile of your movement, or they can be compared to other people's inputs. They can be processed en masse and synthesized, which is very convenient for surveillance or crime investigation, but even more valuable for marketing. In such a fluid economy, based so much on intangibles, the most valuable thing is information on people's patterns and tastes. End of quote. All this information companies gather return to us as consumers as advertising pushing new products. Masumi therefore proposes two apparently contradictory versions of the same phenomenon. On the one hand, he sees capitalism as a promoter of difference, and at the same time, as a promoter of uniformity, of types rather than individuals. Christian Klese provides an example of how to overcome this apparent deadlock and understand the double movement in which capitalism works. In his essay, Modern Primitivism, Non-Mainstream Body Modification and Racialized Representation, Klese discusses the case of the modern primitives that he defines as a subcultural movement in the intersection of the tattoo, piercing and sadomasochism scenes. The philosophy of this movement can be summarized in the quotation that Klese has chosen to open his essay. In it, one of the members of this movement asserts that, and I quote, "I make a statement. I've chosen myself. I am part of this culture, but I don't believe in it. My body modifications are my way to say that." To say that, end of quote. That is, modern primitives express their discontent with society by means of body play, which they see as some spiritual activity. It's like a rite of passage and so on. But the intrinsic irony behind this rejection of consumers' culture, of materialism, is that, as Klese notes, it has been commodified, since there are small businesses of professional piercers and tattoo artists practically in every city. So it has become a profitable market. So what this modern primitive failed to see is the double movement in which capitalism works. First, it tolerates or even promotes difference. But once these movements have become stable, they are reappropriated by corporations and become profitable markets. Now, the question would be how to interpret Violet's small-scale revolution. At first, it seems that Anderson is on every side, since Violet's resistance will cause her destruction. After her feet, the ship starts failing, she sees her life is being threatened. So she calls FitTech, the company that provides her with a connection to the net, for a free repair of the ship. But she's told by Nina that FitTech and other companies have reviewed her purchase history and have decided she's not a reliable investment. This may be seen from Negri's perspective as the rejection of capitalism to Violet's resistance. He has become what Giorgio Agamben calls a homo sacer. Corporations will not kill her nor hurt her, but they will do nothing to prevent her death. Nonetheless, as Nina explains, FitTech's refusal is based on her not buying things. So she offers Violet the chance to revise her case if after a six-month period of great bargains, they can create a consumer portrait for her. As Masumi said, the condition for capitalism to accept difference and diversity is that, literally, they pay. Therefore, Violet's problem is not that she's different, but that her difference is that she doesn't pay. And that's why she left to die. There are two last humiliations that the fit inflicts on her, and that epitomize her defeat. The first I already mentioned is that when she's going to die, she realizes that her ideal of a happy life was borrowed from sitcoms. And the second is that when she's feeling sad, she starts downloading requiems, and Nina offers her some she might like. And to Violet's distress, she finds out that she doesn't like them. As she tells Tyrus, "I've been sketched demographically." So, to sum up, and I finish, In Feet, M.T. Anderson depicts the rebellion of teenager Violet against a society where capitalism and technology have converged in order to keep people under constant surveillance. Everything they show an interest for, everything they like, buy, see, and so on, is registered by corporations so they can create a personal customer profile for each one of them. So to fight against this, she decides to resist, following Negri's theories, but she fails because, as I said, her revolution has placed her out of the market. She's not profitable, so she's not. There is no need for a corporation to allow her to live. So that was my point.